Hey everyone, and welcome to Tara Tea. I'm your host, Tara, and today, finally, we are covering Scream 2. I know, I'm so behind. It is January, and this is coming out, and it was supposed to come out in December, and I'm supposed to have a January episode that's special, and just, I'm behind, y'all. I'm so behind. But we're here. We're finally covering Scream 2. It came out originally on December 12th, 1997, and it had one hell of a pre-production schedule, as it was set to release less than a year after Scream. They then had a famous script leak, and it was just a wild ride from the beginning. So, let's jump into it. The movie begins at a theater showing a sneak preview of Stab. Maureen Evans and Phil Stevens are in line for Stab, and we find out that they got their tickets for free. Maureen is less than thrilled.
Well, I'm gonna tell you what it is, okay? What? It's a dumbass white movie about some dumbass white girls getting their white asses cut the fuck up, okay?
Yeah, I suppose Sandra Bullock is Miss Ethnicity, right?
Well, no, all I'm saying is that the horror genre is historical for excluding the African-American element.
Well, how you get your PhD in black cinema, Sister Soldier?
Listen, I read my Entertainment Weekly, okay? I know my shit.
Yeah, Maureen, I read my Black Beat too, homie.
To that, I recommend Horror Noir on Shudder. I've mentioned it a million times. You should watch it if you haven't. She's absolutely correct, and it's totally worth the deep dive into black horror. Anyways, they're handed costumes from the studio, which are Ghostface costumes with glow-in-the-dark knives. They arrive just as the movie begins, and we see that the theater is actually, like, rolling ghost faces on a dummy throughout the crowd. The credits say that it's based on the Woodsboro murders by Gail Weathers, and we see that the movie was filmed in Stabovision, which basically means blacklight, so the toy knives glow. Everything with Stab is neon green, so theoretically, the Stab ghost face could also glow in the dark. Fun fact, all of the Stab scenes were actually directed by Robert Rodriguez. We start our opening with Stab Casey, which is of course her getting in the shower. Maureen is asking why she has to be naked. The crowd loudly cheers and reacts to everything. And in real life, with a brand new movie, I think it would be less likely, especially with the start of a franchise. However, when I saw Scream in Chicago, it was very similar, minus the murder. We hear the start of a phone call, and Maureen shouts that she should hang up and star 69 his ass. She's shushed, but when the crowd sees Ghostface, they all stand up and scream. Maureen asks Phil for money to get popcorn and leaves. She jumps, hearing the screams from the crowd. She orders, and we hear the people behind her talking about how it's a true story. Maureen goes to the door to go back into the theater, and Phil jumps out to scare her with the Ghostface mask on. She tells him that she doesn't like to be scared, and he tries to tell her that it's great foreplay. She doesn't react well, and he tells her they can go see the new Sandra Bullock movie, which in 1997 was Speed 2, but if this movie takes place 2 years later, then it's 1998 and Hope Floats is on. She tells him that it's already started and they can stay. He goes to the bathroom while she goes back to the movie, and we get a few more clips of Stab. Phil gets in the bathroom and sees two ghost faces taking forever to pee. He goes to use a stall, but it's occupied, so he goes into the next one. He goes to start peeing with the door open, mind you, but I guess men are used to stalls, but whatever. And he hears someone start to whisper. The subtitles will tell us that they're saying, "I swear I'll be good, I'll tell you why I did it, mommy." The way Ghostface is speaking, it almost sounds like a woman moaning, so Phil laughs and leans in for a better sound with his ear against the wall. Ghostface stabs his knife through the wall and right into Phil's head. He waits for the other Ghostfaces to leave and then takes Phil's jacket. Ghostface sits beside Maureen, and she tells him to give it up because of the mask that he's wearing. She tells him that the girl's about to get it and offers him some popcorn, which he shakes his head no to. She tells him that if this was her, she'd be out of there. Stab Ghostface attacks, and Maureen hides in Ghostface's shoulder. She feels something wet on the jacket and has blood all over her hands. Ghostface grabs his knife and stabs her. Maureen gets up, walking out of the aisle, with Ghostface behind her, stabbing her multiple times. The crowd is up, and some are chasing others with a toy knife, and everyone is cheering. Ghostface stabs her a few more times, and Maureen ends up climbing up in front of the screen and screams. Everyone starts removing their masks because they realize that something is wrong, and she collapses. We get our title card and look around Windsor College. In Still Screaming, Rose McGowan shows off a bottle of wine from the rap party that still says Scary Movie, and the vineyard is called Windsor, so I wondered if that's where the name for the college came from, or if it was just a funny coincidence. We hear a phone ring and go into a dorm. Sydney was sleeping, but she wakes up to a voice asking for her favorite movie. She asks who's calling, and he tells her to tell him. She grabs her caller ID, which became very popular after this movie, and says his name and starts rattling off penal codes before he hangs up. Sydney's roommate Hallie comes in and asks if it's time to change their phone number again. Sydney says that it should die off, and it's just because it's the movie's opening weekend. Hallie turns on the TV and Cotton Weary is being interviewed about life after being exonerated. Hallie tells Sydney not to forget the martini mixer with Delta Lambda Zeta, and Sydney tells her that she doesn't think she's gonna be able to make it. Hallie says she promised her it's just a party, and while they're talking about how Sydney needs to let the walls down, a girl comes running up telling them to check the news. It's a news story about the murders. Sydney goes to find Randy, who's in film theory. Sydney goes to find him, and the reporters just keep asking her questions. We cut to film theory, and they're discussing if the murders are caused by the film. Randy jumps in and says that life is life and doesn't imitate anything. Mickey says that the killer patterned his murders after two serial killers who were immortalized on film. The professor asks if someone's trying to make a real-life sequel, and Randy yells that sequels suck, which sparks a whole new discussion. Mickey says that many sequels have surpassed their original, and Cece asks him to name one. A few in the class talk about aliens, and Randy incorrectly corrects one of the students, saying that the line is "stay away from her, bitch," and it always drove me nuts. Like, Randy would not have messed up that line. They could have reshot this, but they already reshot it with a completely different teacher. Plus, they wanted to add Sarah Michelle Gellar to this scene, and they only had her for a small time frame. So, the class ends up agreeing that Godfather Part 2 is better than the original. Sydney arrives, and someone asks Randy what he would do in the sequel. He says he would let the geek get the girl. Sydney tells him that 300 people watched the girl get murdered and thought it was a publicity stunt. She tells him that it's starting again, and he tells her that it's not, and it has nothing to do with them. Sydney tells him that he knows what happened in Woodsboro, and he tells her that he doesn't want to go back there. Sydney's boyfriend Derek arrives, saying that she wasn't in class, and she says she couldn't stand all those "that's her" looks. Gail's on the phone with someone who is telling her that they're threatening to pull the movie. She tells them they'd be stupid with all this free press and that it's going to break box office records. When she gets to her van, she finds her new cameraman, Joel. She tells him that she points and he shoots, and he needs to stay fast on his feet. As they're walking, Debbie Salt comes up and asks to talk to her. Gail tries to refuse, and Debbie says that she read her book and loved it. Debbie tells her that she writes for the Post-Telegraph, and she took Gail's seminar in Chicago, asking all the questions, and Gail says, you know, she thought she looked familiar. Debbie says she can't wait to see the movie, and asks if Gail is getting a lot of flack for it with the violence and cinema issues. Gail says no comment, and Debbie asks for a comment for her story.
Begin quote.
Great.
Your flattering remarks are both desperate and obvious.
Ouch.
End quote.
Ow. Reporters start asking a bunch of questions as she walks away for the press conference. Chief Hartley introduces himself, and Gail immediately asks if the killer will strike again. He says they have no evidence that it's a serial killer. He goes to read a statement, and Gail snaps Joel to focus the camera on her as she asks if they're taking any precautions. He says that they think it's an isolated incident. It fades over to Sydney, Randy, and their friends arriving to the press conference. Randy spots Gail and shows Sydney, and of course pokes a little fun at Gail. Sydney tells him to be kind because she saved their lives. He says that she got calf implants and that he's going to go get a little closer. Lois and Murphy arrive to check on Sydney and ask how she is. They ask Hallie if she's going to bring Sydney to their little thing tonight, and Sydney tries to get out of it, but Hallie confirms that they'll be there. As they walk away, Sydney sees Dewey standing off by himself. Dewey says that he heard what happened and was on the first plane there. They're in, like, Ohio. She says she's fine and she got a starring role in the play, which opens in 2 days. She tells him about her great friends and how she sings someone who's a nice guy that's pre-med with no apparent psychotic tendencies. Dewey says that he was just worried, and if some psycho is going to follow in Billy Loomis's footsteps, that she probably already knows him, or her, or them. She asks what she's supposed to do, cut off everyone and crawl under a rock, and he tells her to watch out. He's going to talk to the local police and stick around. Randy goes to say hi, and Mickey says that Chief Hartley says that the girl was stabbed 7 times. Gail pops up to talk to Sydney, and Cotton steps out from behind her with Joel. Gail is recording asking how she feels. Cotton says he forgives and forgets and would like to move on. Sydney calls Gail a bitch and gets in close. Derek goes to pull her away, and Gail tells her to share with him how she feels, and Sydney punches her in the face, knocking her down. Derek drags Sydney away, and Hallie asks Joel if she got that on film, and he says, "Yes, I got that on film," mocking her. Both lines are completely ad-libbed, but the true star of this scene is the extra in the suit behind them. He looks dead in the camera, winces, and mouths damn. It is absolutely hilarious, and I totally recommend you looking for him the next time you watch Scream 2. It is at 25 minutes and 30 seconds in case you want a timestamp. Cotton asks where Sydney was going because he thought they had an official interview. He asks if she knew or not, and Joel tells Gale that was just cold. Gale tells him to check his conscience at the door and that she's not here to be loved. Cotton says she promised him 10 minutes of national coverage. She yells that he'll get his coverage when she gets her interview. Gale takes off and walks up to Dewey. He tells her to leave Sydney alone. They walk and talk as Dewey starts quoting her book and how she wrote about him.
Page 32. Deputy Dewey filled the room with his Barney Fifish presence.
You read my book?
Oh, yes, I do read, Miss Weathers.
Oh, Dewey, don't take it so seriously. It's a character in a book.
Page 41. Deputy Dewey oozed with inexperience.
Right. Don't you think you're overreacting just a little bit?
No. What I think is that you're money-hungry, fame-seeking, and forgive me for saying mediocre, right? She's got a cold storage shed where her heart should be. No offense intended.
Dewey, I never meant to imply
that. How do you know that my dim-witted inexperience isn't merely a subtle form of manipulation used to lower people's expectations, thereby enhancing my ability to effectively maneuver within any given situation?
She smiles at him and apologizes while going to touch his face. He recoils from her and she apologizes again. He says no. He's the one who's sorry because he misjudged her. We cut to the sorority party and Hallie is trying to show her the benefits of sorority life. Lois and Murphy come up and Murphy goes, "Hi." No, I really mean that. Hi. So fucking stupid. So Sydney says hi back and Lois asks if she wants a drink. Sydney's like, "We'll get it ourselves," and they leave for the kitchen. Over at Omega Beta Zeta, Cece is on the phone with a friend when another call beeps in. It's Ghostface, but she thinks it's her drunk boyfriend, Ted. Ghostface asks who Ted is, and Cece asks who he's calling for because no one's there. She tells him they're co-sponsoring the Acid Rain Mixer with Phi Gamma Alpha tonight, and she's Sober Sister. She asks again who he's calling for, and he's like, "Well, what if I'm asking for you?" She's like, "What if I say goodbye?" And she then asks why he always answers a question with a question, even though she's doing the same thing. He asks if she wants to die tonight, and a call beeps in. For whatever reason, she just clicks back over, and she tells her friend that someone's trying to scare her. She hears a noise upstairs, and she goes to leave the house when she realizes she can't hear her friend anymore. Her friend tells her to call campus security, but they can't hear her with the static from her being outside. She goes back inside to call them back when Donnie grabs her shoulder, scaring her. Phone rings, Donnie grabs it, asking who it is. Ghostface says it's Ted, and then we see Ghostface sneaking in behind them through the open door. Donnie hands the phone to Cece and leaves, telling her not to forget to set the alarm. Cece goes to answer the phone, saying, "Hey Ted, what's up?" And he's like, "You wish it was Ted." And then he tells her to not forget to set the alarm. She throws the phone down, sets the alarm. She hears a noise in the living room and walks towards it. Hears a dog barking, turns back. She sees a door open against the wall and checks behind it. The phone rings again, she answers it, but then Ghostface pops out from the closet and chases her upstairs. They go up to the third floor and she throws a bike at him. He catches up and then throws her through the glass door onto the balcony. The alarm goes off and he stabs her in the back a few times before throwing her off the balcony. The party's in full swing and Murphy and Lois have Sydney in their arms walking her around. They're talking about not being all about blowjobs and how they're being responsible and safe. Lois then asks if harmonica style is okay, and Murphy's like, "Oh yeah." Randy comes up with drinks, and Sydney asks what took him so long. He takes back off as they talk about how Derek is in a Big Brother frat and they want to keep it all in the family. Sydney greets Derek, and Mickey comes up asking Hallie to dance. Mickey tells Randy that Empire Strikes Back was a better sequel, and Randy tells him that it's not a sequel but part of a planned trilogy. Hallie says that she likes the little furry things, and Mickey says that Ewoks blow. Derek asks Sydney if the twits are being nice to her and asks if she'll be pledging. She says no, and then Lois and Murphy get everyone to come see that there are a ton of police over at Omega Beta Zeta. Everyone runs out, and Debbie Salt is getting info as Gale comes up. She tells her about the victim and says that she has to leave because of her deadline. Gale asks Dewey if it's happening again, and he says she'd like that. He also tells her to hurry up so she doesn't get scooped. Gale hollers for Joel again, and he says he's not cut out for this. She tells him not to fuck with her and heads towards the sorority house. Derek and Sydney stay behind to watch, and Sydney goes into the house to get her jacket when the phone rings. She goes to leave, but then walks past another phone and decides to answer it. Of course, it's Ghostface, and he's asking if she remembers him and tells her that it's showtime. She asks him to show his face and calls him a fucking coward, and then he comes up behind her to attack her. Sydney screams for Derek but can't get the door open. Ghostface stabs the knife through the door and Derek sees it. He can't get inside to her, so Ghostface is chasing Sydney all throughout the sorority house. She goes out through the back door and runs into Derek. He goes into the house after Ghostface when Dewey comes running up. We hear a struggle, and then Dewey goes inside to see that Derek's arm has been sliced. Derek tells him which direction that Ghostface went, and Dewey goes after him to find the front door open and Lois and Murphy just standing there. Dewey tends to Derek's wounds while Sydney watches. We cut to the hospital and see that Mickey was being interviewed, and they tell Hallie that she's next. Mickey says that it was the easiest interrogation of his life. Hallie goes to get coffee, and Mickey checks on Sydney. She tells him that she knew this was coming and that this isn't over. Mickey tells her that they're all there for her. Sydney references Cece and says that Derek could have been killed. Mickey says that he wasn't, and now he knows that the 90s are no time to play hero. He asks why he went back into the house, and Sydney gets a strange look on her face as if she's asking herself the same question. We cut to Derek's interrogation. The doctor tells him that he's lucky that there's no nerve damage and that he needs to take it easy. They ask if Ghostface just cut him and then walked away. Dewey says it's awful convenient and that it's a shame that he got away. Derek says it's a shame that he got there too late, right after Ghostface disappeared. Back on campus, Chief Hartley is talking to Gale and Dewey. He writes the names on the wall, and this scene drives me insane. The list says Maureen, then Phil, then Cece. However, Phil was killed first in the movie, so his name should be on top. But for plot reasons, it's not. Gale asks if Cece is her real name. Of course it's not. It's Casey. So then Gale shows that the names match the victims in Woodsboro, so they're recreating Woodsboro. But they're not, because they're out of order. Not to mention this plot gets dropped damn near immediately. Dewey asks how they're keeping Sydney safe, and Hartley says he has his two best detectives guarding her. In the original script, this is where they look through the roster of the college to see if there's a Hembree or a Riley to go with Principal Hembree's death and Tatum's death to try to get ahead of the killer. It's where we could have had a moment for Dewey to acknowledge his sister's death, and they could have put protection on Dewey since, you know, his last name is Riley. But instead, they don't do that. We cut back to Sydney. Derek's asking how he can get her alone with these detectives, and she tells him that it's probably in his best interest to stay away from her. She tells him that he's already gotten hurt, she doesn't want to see that happen again. He asks if this has to do with his well-being or her not trusting him. She hesitates and says that she doesn't want to see him get hurt. He says he doesn't want to see her get hurt either. She walks away and the detectives follow. Gale and Dewey leave Chief Hartley's office, and Gale says that she's going to go to admissions and asks if he's game. He says he's not here to write a book, he's here to help Sydney. She tells him that she wants to help her too. He gives her a look and she says, well, of course I want to help myself too. She asks him to smile and he says that he'll smile once they catch the killer. Debbie Salt and a few reporters start asking Gale questions after Dewey's walked off. A reporter asks if Sydney's father is a suspect, and Debbie says that he's out of the country on business, but that sounds fishy, and asks Gale what she thinks. Gale says that she's not here to do her job, so then Debbie starts asking about Dewey and what he's doing here. Gale says that Dewey's a good guy, unlike some of them. She walks off, and Debbie says that if the killer is repeating Woodsboro, then they could be from Woodsboro. So then we cut to the cafeteria, where Mickey asks Derek if he thinks that Sydney will let him interview her, and Hallie's like, oh yeah, she turned down Primetime Live 2020 and Dateline, but you! Mickey asks about Randy and if he could be a little off now. Derek and Hallie are completely against the idea, and Hallie says that he's harmless. Mickey says that's what they said about Dahmer, and as Sydney arrives, Derek kind of hushes them all up. The detectives are a few tables away, and Hallie asks about them. Sydney says that Officer Richards is a Capricorn, divorced father of two, and Officer Andrews is a single Gemini who might be gay. So then Mickey asks Derek what he's thinking about, and he starts singing I Think I Love You. Sydney tries to stop him, but that makes him sing louder. The cast said that they hated this song, and they hated hearing it all day, so no one was thrilled about this scene. So everyone starts clapping along as Derek climbs on various tables, everyone's cheering as he finishes, and he gives his Greek letters to Sydney. Mickey asks if that's a big faux pas, and Hallie says that it is, and that the brothers are going to get him. Sydney and Derek kiss. We then see a clip of Tori Spelling being interviewed with a Stab poster. Hilariously, they got her to play Sydney in the Stab portion of the movie, even with the comments in Scream. Randy and Dewey are in a shop when Randy says they got Joe Blow Nobody to play him. He tells Dewey that at least he got David Schwimmer, which I find very hard to believe that David Schwimmer would be in a horror movie. Obviously, it's a Friends reference, but still. They watch a clip from Stab, which is the scene of Sydney running into Billy before the bathroom attack. Luke Wilson is hilariously playing a very greasy Billy. One thing I've always wondered, though, is how did they know about this scene? Did Sydney tell Gale about this? if she's turning down interviews, was this important enough to tell the police? Obviously, the point of this scene is to remind us that Mrs. Loomis left Mr. Lewis, because then we remember that it was because of Maureen Prescott. Randy says that he'll wait for it to come out on video, and funny enough, in the original script, Randy and Sydney actually go to see the movie together, because they kind of rebond, because remember, he's Gail's cameraman, he's not there at the college, so they haven't seen each other, and so once they are around each other, they want to spend more time together. Randy says that if someone is out to make a sequel, then they need to observe the rules of a sequel.
Number one, the body count is always bigger. Number two, the death scenes are always much more elaborate. More blood, more gore. Carnage, candy. Your core audience just expects it. And number three, if you want your sequel to become a franchise, never, ever...
How do we find the killer, Randy? That's what I want to know.
Let's look at the suspects. There's Derek, the obvious boyfriend. Hello, Billy Loomis. The guy's pre-med and his pity me surface wound conveniently missed every major vein and artery.
So you think it's Derek?
Not so fast. Let's assume the killer, or Urs, has a half a brain. He's not a Nick at Night rerun type of guy. He wants to break some new ground, right?
Right.
So forget the boyfriend. It's tired. Who else do we got?
There's...
Mickey, the freaky Tarantino film student. But if he's a suspect, so am I. So let's move on.
Let's not move on. Maybe you are a suspect.
Well, if I'm a suspect, you're a suspect.
You have a point. Okay, let's move on to...
Hallie.
Sid's roommate?
Mm-hmm.
Serial killers are typically white males.
That's why it's perfect. It's sort of against the rules, but not really.
He brings up that Mrs. Voorhees was an excellent killer, as of course a nod to the killer mother. Dewey says that these kids are his friends and asks him who he thinks it is. Randy asks about Gail. Dewey is surprised and says she's vicious, but she's not a killer. Randy says she could be planning her next book and reporters stage the news. Randy says that he knows he's sweet on her and Dewey tries to deny it. And he's like, this is me you're talking to, the unrequited love slave of Sidney Prescott. He says he knows all about obsessions and pain as he flashes the scar on his chest. Dewey calls it his love scar and Randy says, you know, you have one too. But then he asks about the limp because he's like, you were stabbed in the back. Dewey says that he has a severed nerve and tells him that Gail is no killer. Randy says if she's not a killer, then she's a target. Gail and Joel are setting up shots. Joel asks why she's here when the attacks are here. He tells her that he should have read her book, and he didn't, but he's reading it now. He says that he read that Kenny was gutted, and said that he's gonna do what any rational person would do, leave. She tells him that she made up Kenny getting gutted, and confirmed that his throat was slashed. Joel says it doesn't matter, and Gail tells him that it's a job, and there's a few drawbacks. He tells her that he wants to report the news, not be the news. She tells him that it's a big chance for him, and asks him if he wants to be a part of it. She tells him that she needs him and can't do it without him. He grabs the camera and they go to film. Sydney is talking to the director of the play that she's going to be in. She tells him that she doesn't think she's going to be able to do it, and he tells her that this is her major, that's what she's here for, and that she's a fighter. He says that Cassandra is a great tragedy, and to use that, and to use everything she's going through to help her through the play. He tells her that Cassandra knew she was cursed and embraced it. Sydney tells him that he's good, and he tells her, well, there's no understudy and I'm desperate. He tells her that she can do this, and they start on the third act. They are in full dress rehearsal. Everyone except for Sydney is wearing these druid stone-looking mask things. She starts her line, and they all begin moving around the stage almost as like a dance, because she's trying to get away from them all, and at one point they have daggers, but she sees Ghostface chasing after her. She's scared and she's again running all through everybody, and she ends up running directly into Ghostface, screams, and collapses to the ground as Ghostface runs off. Everyone else takes off their masks and they're just completely confused as to what's going on. Derek arrives shortly after and Sydney asks how long he's been there. He says he just got here and she asks where Mickey is. In a deleted scene, everyone had started working out times where they could be with Sydney and escort her through campus. Mickey's supposed to pick up Sydney from rehearsals, but Derek says that they had to swap because he needed to edit. Sydney tells Derek that she needs to be alone, and he tells her that alone is not the answer. She tells him that it is, and she needs distance. He asks if he gets a say in any of this, and she says no. Derek leaves, and we cut to Gail. Gail's phone rings, and she tells whoever it is that she'll call him back. Gail, Dewey, Randy, and Joel are trying to figure out who the killer is and where they'll attack next. Gail's phone rings again, and she yells at whoever that she will call Bob back. Dewey comments on her smoking, and Randy says that she started smoking when the nude photos came out. Gail says they were Jennifer Anderson's body, which is of course another Friends reference. Gail says that there were more victims before the home stretch: Tatum, Hembree, her cameraman.
Time out. See, I don't need to be hearing about no dead cameraman, all right? Now, I'm warning you guys, I am a verb away from vacating these premises. I'm gonna go get me some coffee, donuts, Prozac, see if I can find some crack, Special K, X, not Malcolm, and I'll be back when you guys start talking about something a little more saved by the bellish, all right?
Dewey says that he seems shaky, and she says not to worry about him, but they need to figure out the pattern. Dewey says they were all involved in Woodsboro, and it could be any of them, which is our signal that it's no longer going to follow the pattern. As soon as they announce the pattern is gone, and it is just stupid. Gale calls him a bonehead and asks him if he just wants to sit around and wait for someone to drop dead, and he says he doesn't know, and then the phone rings again, so he calls her a phonehead. Randy picks up Gale's phone, saying she's not there, and Ghostface, who's watching them, asks if he's ever felt a knife go through human flesh and scrape the bone beneath. Gale tells him that it's the killer, and they all get up and start looking around. Dewey tells him to keep him on the phone while they look for him. Randy asks Ghostface what his favorite movie is, and Ghostface says they'll never find him. Randy tells him to let them have their fun and starts walking around. Ghostface asks for his favorite scary movie, and he says Showgirls. Randy starts checking people with phones and starts naming off horror movies centered around colleges, asking if he's close to his favorite scary movie. Ghostface says he's closer than he thinks, and someone runs into Randy while chasing a football. He asks if he wants to die, and Randy says Billy and Stu are much more original. Gale and Dewey take someone's phone away, and they're like, "Who's this?" And the person on the phone is like, "Who are you?" And Gale's like, "Gale Weathers, author of the Woodsboro Murders," as if that is like her official title, and it's hilarious. So Dewey sees a white male at 9 o'clock, and they decide to go around him to catch him from the front and the back, completely off guard, in case it's Ghostface. So Ghostface asks Randy why he's even there, because he'll never be the leading man. Randy yells, "Fuck you," and Ghostface continues saying that he'll never be the hero and he'll never get the girl. Randy chases someone on a phone near the van. Ghostface says, "Wrong one, dead boy." Randy's like, "Let's redirect here for a moment." Gale and Dewey attack the guy and realize it's not him. Randy asks why Ghostface is copying two loser-ass dickheads. He calls Stu a wet rag and then calls Billy a rat-looking, homo-repressed mama's boy. He tells Ghostface that he should set his goals higher, and is telling him that he should be one of the big boys like Manson, Bundy, or OJ. Unfortunately, his back is to the van and he doesn't hear the door opening while ranting. Ghostface grabs him and slams the news van shut. A group of guys with a boombox walks by, and they don't notice that the van's moving. Randy is slammed against the window, and it shatters. Then he is stabbed over and over again. Ghostface leaves, and we see blood pouring out of the van. Dewey realizes that Randy is missing, and they run looking for him. Joel walks up asking what's going on when he notices the van. They open it with Gale screaming at Randy's dead body. Joel faints. Cindy's at the library when her screen freezes. The guy next to her says she has an instant message that someone in the library had to have sent her a message. She opens it and it says she's gonna die tonight. She tells the detectives and another message comes up saying the police can't save her. They get her away from the computer and have her stand in the hallway by herself. They start checking computers and Cotton comes up asking if she's okay and if he can talk to her. She tells him that this isn't a good time and he tells her that she sent him to prison for a year so she can give him 2 minutes. He pulls her into a stairwell and she says that she doesn't know how to apologize more to him. He tells her not to be sorry and that he has the solution to all of their problems. He tells her to forget Gale because she doesn't see the story between them. He asks if she's read the book. He then tells her that Diane Sawyer called and offered them the entire hour if they do the interview together. She tells him that she can't. He tells her they're getting paid $10,000 each and he's got a sweet side deal with a 900 number. She tries to stop him and he puts his hands in front of her face, waving them around saying he knows she doesn't like the press and he respects it, but it's Diane Sawyer. This could be very, very heavy exposure and he puts his hands on her shoulders. She tells him that between the movie, the book, and everything else, everyone knows the truth and that they need to move on. She asks why he would want more exposure and Cotton blocks her way. He says he deserves a little exposure. He starts walking towards her, so now she's walking backwards down the stairs. He tells her that she dragged his name through the mud and all he's asking for is one fucking Diane Sawyer interview to get his side of the story straight. He says he doesn't think he's being unreasonable. She tells him she's sorry, but no. He says that he bets she's sorry and grabs her arm as she walks past him. He tells her it's a good angle to be lovable and fucked up Sidney Prescott, everyone's favorite little victim. At this point, he is yelling at her. So the detectives come right over, they cuff him, and then Cotton yells for Sidney saying, "You know, I'm not Billy Loomis, you killed him, remember?" Hartley starts asking Cotton why he attacked Sydney, and Cotton's like, there was no attack, we were talking very heatedly because we have a very complicated past. They start to question Cotton to see if the killer is, you know, him. Dewey has now told Sydney about Randy, and she says that it should have been her. She wants to call his mother, and Dewey tells Sydney that he's already taken care of that. Dewey asks if she's okay, and she tells him to stop treating her like she'll like glass because she's not gonna break. Hallie says it's okay to break, and Sydney says that it won't happen. Hartley tells Cotton that his alibi had better be airtight, and Cotton says that he wants to remind everyone that he's an innocent man. So until they find him standing over a dead body with a knife in his hand, they had better treat him with the rights and privileges accorded to every innocent citizen in this country. We, of course, quickly find out that Cotton is not the killer, and they can't hold him, and he's free to go. Cotton sees Gail and asks if she's enjoying the show. She asks him what it is that he's doing, and he says, waiting for my 15 minutes of fame. She tells him not to do anything stupid, and he says that she was so instrumental in his freedom, and asks if she's having character doubts now, and walks away. Cotton tries to give Sydney his card, and Hartley makes him leave. Dewey says they're going to take her somewhere safe, and Hallie says she'll be with her. Hartley says they're going to take her to her dorm so she can pack up because everyone else is getting locked in after dark. Sydney asks if it's not Cotton, then who is it? Dewey says he doesn't know, but they'll find him. Gail goes outside and a bunch of reporters start asking her questions. Cotton comes out and the reporters go to him. Cotton tries to get Gail to come over for a photo op, but she walks away. Debbie Salt asks how she's doing and says it must be scary knowing that someone is watching and enjoying all of this. Gail's like, all right, local woman, I know you hold me up as your career template and it must give you a charge to challenge me, but you need to give it a rest. Debbie tells her that this was obviously the wrong time and apologizes. Joel walks up and says they impounded his van as a crime scene. He gives her her footage and then leaves in a cab. Dewey comes out and Gail tells him that she feels really bad. She says she never says this because she normally doesn't, but she does now. Dewey asks if this is some brilliant Gail Weathers performance, and she tells him there aren't any cameras and she just wants to find the killer. Dewey tells her that he does too and picks up her camera bag and so they can go over the footage. They realize that they can probably see the killer in the footage. They head to the film school to look it all over, and they start to put in a tape but drop it, and then they hit heads going to pick it up. They look through the footage and realize that Joel was recording while they were fighting. Gail tells him that he's cute when he's angry, and Dewey says that he was being rude. Gail apologizes to him and says that she didn't mean to hurt him. They kiss and climb on the table when suddenly a different TV comes on and it starts showing each victim. The view changes and they realize they are now on the screen and the killer is there filming them. Dewey takes off after him, but he's gone. The killer is behind Gail and she takes off running. Dewey trips down the stairs and Gail smacks Ghostface in the face with a phone. She takes off down the hall. She's trying a bunch of doors and can't get in. Finally, she gets into a sound room and locks the door. She goes into a different room and closes the door. She's now in a recording studio. She goes to walk past the window when she sees Ghostface in the other room and hides. He comes in the booth and she starts hiding behind the soundproof walls. They go back and forth through different sides of these soundproof walls and it is a fantastic cat and mouse scene. She goes to try a door and it's locked. She ends up running into a closet and hides. Dewey goes into the studio and sees Gail through the window, but she can't see him because when he goes to knock on the door and yell for her, it's soundproof. Ghostface sneaks up behind him and stabs Dewey in the back. Dewey falls on the sound equipment, turns the mic on, screaming for Gail. She watches him fall to the ground in silence because we can't hear her scream now because we're on Dewey's side. Besides the score, we can't hear anything, and this is one of my favorite parts of this movie. Ghostface tries to get in the closet, but she's knocked over a shelf, blocking herself in. He starts throwing things at the glass, trying to break it, but he can't. She covers her face, but when she looks back up, he's gone. We cut back to Sydney, who's getting ready to leave her dorm, and we see Derek waiting for her. They go to talk when Hallie arrives, saying that she's her therapist, and throws her bag to the detective. Sydney says that she's okay, and Hallie gets into the car. The detectives say they have to leave, and Derek tells Sydney when this is all over, he'll still be there. If Derek was the killer, this would have been a fantastic and creepy line, because he's delivering everything in such a weird way to be like a red herring, and it's just great. She gets in the car and they leave, and we see people in brown cloaks running for Derek. It's his brothers because he gave up his letters, and of course we see Lois and Murphy involved as well. They all go to the auditorium and tie him up to the star that's lowered down during the play. They're spraying him with beer, asking him who he loves, which of course he's saying Sydney. We got back to the cop car and Hallie's asking where they're going, and Detective Andrews says, "Don't ask, don't tell." Suddenly, Ghostface is there. He breaks out the window. He slashes Detective Andrews' throat and then climbs over the roof, kicking Detective Richards in the face. He slams his head against the car a few times and throws him in front of it. Ghostface climbs in the car, and when Detective Richards stands up pointing a gun at him, he goes to run him over. So Detective Richards is on the windshield when Ghostface starts trying to drive erratically, I guess to throw him off, and then goes into a construction area. They crash into a wall, and a pipe goes through Detective Richards' head, killing him. Hallie and Sydney are trapped in the back of the cop car and can't get out. Ghostface is knocked out in front of them. They try to break the glass and can't, but the pipe knocked off a part of the cage, so Sydney and Hallie peel it down and climb out through the back seat. Sydney can't get out through the passenger side because they're against a wall. She has to crawl over Ghostface. She goes to take off the mask and accidentally hits the horn, so then she tries again to climb out. She gets out through the window, but she can't open the back door to get to Hallie, so Hallie has to do the exact same thing now. She gets Hallie out of the car, they go to run, and they take off for a bit, but then Sydney's like, "No, I want to know who it is." And Hallie's like, "No, stupid people go back. We're smart. Smart people run, so we should run." Sydney tells her that she's tired of running, and she has to know. Hallie's like, "We'll go get the police." And Sydney's like, "No, he'll be gone when they get back." So she runs towards the car and sees that he's gone. She turns around and Ghostface grabs Hallie and stabs her in the chest multiple times. Sydney takes off running towards the campus. Gail comes running out of the film room and runs into Cotton. She sees blood all over him and he's like, "No, no, no, it's not what it looks like." He tells her that he found Dewey and he tried to help him, but Gail takes off running. She grabs a payphone outside that Debbie Salt's using and Debbie's like, "I was in the middle of a story." Gail's like, "I've got your damn story. Cotton's the killer." And Debbie is, of course, shocked. We go to the auditorium where music starts playing. Sydney hears it outside and goes inside thinking the director's there. Instead, the music cuts off, a spotlight comes on, and part of the set comes down. She tries leaving, and another part comes down right in front of her, kind of blocking her in. The spotlight then goes on Derek's shirt, and she sees it, so the spotlight goes out. She walks to the edge of the stage, and the sun comes down with Derek tied to it. She takes the mask off of him and the tape from his mouth. Derek's like, "The brothers got him," and Sydney's like, "No, no, no, the killer's here. He's after us. He's already killed Hallie." Derek asks where the killer is, and he says, "Right here." They turn around to see Ghostface walking towards them. Derek tells her to untie him, and Ghostface asks if she really wants to trust her boyfriend. He says, "Don't you know that history repeats itself?" And we realize at this point that there's no voice effect, and it's Mickey. He takes off the mask, and we see that there's a voice changer in the mask, so that's what allows him to talk like Ghostface without being on the phone or anything like that. Mickey says that since Derek disappeared on his ass, he's been on his own all night. Derek says that he's crazy and that Sydney knows him better than that. Mickey's like, "Come on, Sydney, you know, I have to have a partner. I couldn't have done this on my own." Sydney believes him at first, and Derek says that he's crazy. Mickey's like, "It's okay, Derek, we got her." Derek yells that he's lying, and he keeps asking her to untie him, and so Mickey asks Derek if he thinks that Sydney is experiencing deja vu. Derek says that he's going to kill Mickey, and then Mickey takes out a gun and shoots Derek in the chest. Sydney apologizes to Derek, and he says that he would have never hurt her, and dies. Mickey tells her that she should deal with her trust issues because Derek was completely innocent. He tells her that he's the kind of boy that you would like to take home to mom if you had a mom. She yells, "Fuck you," and Mickey says, "Did Billy let you talk to him like this?" And Sydney says that Billy was a sick fuck just like him. Mickey's like, "No, Billy was a sick fuck that wanted to get away with it. Mickey is a sick fuck that wants to get caught." He says he has his whole defense planned out. He's gonna blame the movies. He's like, "This is the beginning, a prelude to the trial." He's saying these days it's all about a trial and it's airtight, and that he's gonna be the innocent victim. She tells him that he's psychotic, and he shushes her, saying that that'll be their little secret. While he's talking, she slipped off her necklace that was like the Greek letters that Derek gave her and has it dangling in her hands. He says that he worked hard to give the audience what they want. He says that's what Billy was good at, execution. Sydney tells him that he forgot one thing about Billy Loomis. She fucking killed him. She takes the necklace and swings it in his face, scratching him with it. He drops the knife and she kicks him. They fight back and forth. Mickey grabs the gun, telling her that she has a Linda Hamilton thing going on, that he likes it. Derek's body raises up and Mickey's like, "Oh, who's doing that?" He says he told her that he had a partner and it's a surprise cameo just for her. Now, the rest of the time that Mickey talks through this movie, he talks so weird And it's just an odd character choice. So I don't know. Like, it would make sense if she had cut his mouth, too. Like, if she'd swung it twice. Because, like, she bloodies up his eyes if she, like, cut his eyeball. And, like, he talks as if his mouth is cut. So I don't know what's happening here, but whatever. So Gail walks in with Debbie Salt behind her. Sydney looks at her and she's like, Mrs. Loomis? And of course, we now know Debbie Salt is Billy's mother. Gail's like, no, it can't be. I've seen pictures. Sydney's like, this is 60 pounds and a lot of work later. Mrs. Loomis tells her that it's called a makeover, and she tells Gail she should try because she looks a little tired. Mickey said that he had to have financing because tuition is expensive. He tells him that they met on the internet on a psycho website. Mrs. Loomis says there's an estimated 97 active serial killers in the country today, so Mickey was quite a find on the up and up. He just needed a little guiding and nurturing. Mickey says that he told her it was going to work and he can't wait for the trial because it's going to rock. Mrs. Loomis tells him that there won't be a trial and shoots him a few times. Gail goes to get his gun and he shoots her in the stomach. Gail falls off the stage and Mickey collapses to the ground. Mrs. Loomis cracks up because she's like, two birds, one stone. She tells Sydney that Mickey was a good boy, but his blame the movie motive. She asks if Sydney bought it and tells her that the poor boy was completely out of his mind. Sydney's like, and you're not? Mrs. Loomis says, no, I'm very sane. She also doesn't blink a whole lot through this, which freaked me out. I know they did that with Hannibal Lecter and Silence of the Lambs, but, like, Laura Metcalf has some, like, very expressive eyes, and so to see her just, like, wide-eyed not blinking freaked me out. She says that her motive isn't as 90s as Mickey's. Hers is good old-fashioned revenge. She tells Sydney that she killed her son, and now she kills her, and she can't think of anything more rational. Sydney tells her that she won't get away with it. Mrs. Loomis has now picked up the gun, and she's like, of course I will. Everything's traceable to Mickey.
But let's just suppose that you had gotten hold of the other cop's gun, and you chased Mickey, and there was a big shootout, a big scuffle, and you shot Mickey, killed Mickey dead.
By the way, is a hilarious line that I use quite a bit in real life when I'm talking about someone dying in a movie. I'm just like, ooh, they killed them dead.
But not before he got off one shot at you. Okay, so have I covered everything? Are there any questions, any comments? You know what, though? Who gives a flying fuck anyway? Let him try and track down the second possible killer. Debbie Salt doesn't exist.
Sydney tells her that she's just as crazy as her son, and Mrs. Loomis gets this, like, crazed look in her eye. She's like, what did you just say? She's like, was that a negative, disparaging remark about my son, my Billy? Sydney's like, oh no, Billy was a good boy. You did a bang-up job. Mrs. Loomis says that it's not wise to patronize a woman with a gun. She says that Randy did that, and she got a little knife happy. She tells Sydney that she's tired of hearing that it all starts with the parents. She's like, if you want to blame anyone, blame your mother. She stole my husband, broke up my family, and then Sydney took her son. She tells her that she doesn't know what it means to be a mother, to teach and to guide them, and Sydney's like, oh, and abandon them? And then she asks if Mickey is supposed to be dead. Mrs. Loomis turns around and Sydney breaks a beer bottle on her head. She then starts hiding behind the set, and Mrs. Loomis is shooting, trying to, like, figure out where she's at and shoot her with a gun, but Mrs. Loomis looks through the bullet hole and sees Sydney grab an axe. Sydney starts slicing at the ropes, holding up lights and pieces of the set. She's turning on different lights and making it sound like a storm. She's turning on the fire and the smoke, and pieces of the set are now falling down. Lights come crashing down, almost hitting Mrs. Loomis. She tries to climb up the set to go through where it hit, only to have rocks fall down and knock her down. Sydney stops everything to listen for her. She ends up trying to duck around behind the curtain, but Mrs. Loomis pops out trying to stab her. Sydney runs out to the stage with Mrs. Loomis not far behind. Sydney ducks down and Mrs. Loomis climbs on top of her trying to stab her, but she gets one of the fake stones to block herself with. Sydney goes to run away and Mrs. Loomis grabs her and strangles her while trying to stab her with the other hand. They both see the gun and try to go for it when Cotton shoots a warning shot. Mrs. Loomis grabs Sydney and holds a knife to her throat. Cotton says that he has had a very bad day and he just wants someone to tell him what the fuck is going on. Sydney's like, meet Billy's mother, she's the killer. He almost trips over Mickey and Sydney's like, yeah, and that's the other killer. Cotton says hi to Mrs. Loomis and confirms that she's not with the Post-Telegraph. She tells him that she can still help him, that he doesn't need Sydney, and just like, let me kill her. She's like, as long as she's alive, you're never going to be the lead story. If you let me kill her, you'll be the only survivor and the star. She then yells, she sent you to prison for a year. And I find that poetic. So Cotton looks at Sydney and starts pointing the gun at her, and Sydney's like, no, don't listen to her. He tells Sydney that she's in quite a predicament and that he bets that Diane Sawyer interview is looking really good right now. So they stare at each other, and Sydney's like, consider it done. So Cotton shoots the gun, and Sydney and Mrs. Loomis fall back and hit the ground. Sydney coughs and gets up. Cotton's like, that was intense. Like, I would never do anything to hurt you. She's like, give me the gun. He gives it right to her, and he's like, oh, yeah, sure. He tells her they should talk about what happened and get their story straight. Sydney bends down to look at Mrs. Loomis when Gail grabs her hand. They help Gail out of the pit. Sydney grabs the other gun that Mickey had. Gail says that the bullet bounced off her rib, and Cotton says she has more lives than a cat. Gail takes one of the guns from Sydney and asks if Mrs. Loomis is dead. Sydney says she doesn't know, but they always come back. So suddenly then Mickey jumps up screaming. Sydney and Gail just start shooting him over and over again until he collapses. Sydney looks at Mrs. Loomis and shoots her in the head just like she did with Billy, just in case. She throws the gun down and they walk outside. Gail gets outside and Joel comes up saying that he's back and they can get the scoop. He goes to record and he's like, all right, we're here at Windsor College. You're Gail Weathers. Let's go. When they suddenly hear one of the paramedics yell, we have a live one. Gail sees that Dewey is still alive. The paramedics say that the knife went into the old scar tissue and it saved his life. Gail gets into the ambulance with Dewey and they head to the hospital. Sydney is surrounded by reporters and they ask her how it feels to be a hero. She tells them to talk to Cotton because he's the hero. They all run to Cotton and Sydney and Cotton share a nod. He tells them that there is a time, a place, and a price for everything. They ask Cotton to tell them something, and he says it'll make a hell of a movie. We get an overhead shot of Sydney walking away, and we pass by a bell tower. There was talk that the original ending was also going to have a third ghost face in the bell tower, which obviously they took out. So we zoom out over the landscape of Windsor College, and of course, right before the real credits start, we get a ghost face jump scare. And that's the movie! So now for all of our behind-the-scenes info. When Scream was still in theaters, they began pre-production. The title was toyed with, they had thought of Scream Louder, Scream Again, even Scream the sequel, but they ended up sticking with Scream 2. Kevin had penned a little treatment for the sequel in the back of the original script so they had a starting point ready to go. The finished script famously leaked online during pre-production, so they had to have messengers coming back and forth to pick up the script, and even had this weird brown paper down the center to prevent photocopies, highlights, any of that. The script ended up having to be retooled multiple times because Kevin Williamson was also working on Dawson's Creek, so it required multiple people working on the script and fact-checking each other's timelines. It's basically why the movie starts out as a copycat of Woodsboro, and then they forget that storyline entirely. Honestly, if you've seen the script online, the ending would have likely tanked the series. The beginning and middle are okay, but it ends with, and this is all I've got so far, with a quick blurb. Derek and Hallie were originally the killers, along with Cotton and Mrs. Loomis. Basically, Mrs. Loomis was financing Derek and Hallie, and when Cotton comes in to, see what's all happening like he does in the actual movie, he ends up turning bad. Randy was working as Gail's cameraman, and Joel was actually a pre-med student and friends with Derek, who was the film student. Mickey was in it, and he and Hallie were dating and Greek life, and he's the one that is supposed to be singing. But he sings I'll Always Love You to Hallie. And honestly, I think I prefer how the characters were set up in that original script and wish they could have, meshed it together some more. You also didn't have a killer disappear throughout most of the film like Mickey does. Mrs. Loomis also says that she told Billy to kill Maureen, and so it would have made her character even more insane because she helped Billy plan it all, and it would have messed up their retconning from Scream 3. Funnily enough, Kevin Williamson is now on record as of 2017 said that the leaked script was a dummy script. And yeah, I probably would have said the same thing if my terrible script had leaked like this, but according to him, there were three dummy scripts, one of which was a Dewey is the killer script, and he says that this was never the real ending and the real story. If that's the case, then why was there such a huge rewrite? Why did everyone say, oh my god, our entire script got leaked, we had to rewrite the whole movie? They are literally on record saying that they were getting pages during shooting and that they were not fully fleshed out and they had to figure out the characters' relationships on the spot. And I mean, there are even spots in the script where all it says, because they show pictures, is Wes will make this scary. Casting with Scream 2 was absolutely insane. Everybody wanted to be in the sequel. The original surviving cast came back, with Neve Campbell being contractually obligated during the original Scream. Production enjoyed casting the movie within a movie because with Stab they could get even campier and go beyond your standard casting expectations. The opening scene had Jada Pinkett Smith and Omar Epps, but originally production was eyeing Alicia Silverstone and Liv Tyler. Production was very happy to get Sarah Michelle Gellar because of her Buffy fame, but they also had to turn their schedule upside down to accommodate her, which included flying her back and forth. Rebecca Gayhart, who missed out on being Tatum in Scream, auditioned for Cece, Hallie, and Maureen. Natasha Gregson-Wagner and Paula Marshall both auditioned for Cece and Hallie. Elise Neal said that when she went into her audition, she was just being goofy and crazy and was so surprised that she booked it. Eric Mabius auditioned for Derek, but the casting team just ended up loving Jerry O'Connell. Jamie Kennedy revealed in his series How I Got Cast that Tobey Maguire was in consideration for Mickey, but Mickey ended up being Timothy Oliphant's first real leading role in a film. The cast talks about how new he was, but that it was something fun and cheeky for him to do. Laurie Metcalf got the script fresh off the end of Roseanne and thought that everyone would just root for Debbie Salt. And then once she saw the blacked out pages in her script, she figured out she was Ghostface. During filming to avoid the MPAA's wrath, they filmed everything with more violence and blood so it would be easier to get the rating that they wanted. Of course, the version that they filmed with the extra stuff was accepted without any edits required, so they had to trim it themselves. Originally, Phil's death involved him getting stabbed in the ear 3 times instead of just 1, and they also show Randy's throat getting slashed. Jamie Kennedy talks about how he had his parents come down to watch his death scene. His mom actually sat with Roger L. Jackson, and Jamie asked him to do some ad-libbing and really tried to scare the hell out of him. Roger L. Jackson said he made some comments about killing his mom to freak him out, and the line, "cutting through your flesh until I hit bone," was an ad-lib line that stayed in the film. After the scene was over, Jamie Kennedy said that he went to shower to get cleaned up, and everyone was gone. He said he came out and he was completely alone in this college after sundown. He said this was the only time that he'd been scared while filming any type of horror movies, and that was only because he felt like it was a bad cliche that he would film a death scene and then be killed. Turns out all that happened was that he went to the wrong showers. When it came time to figure out what to do with Joel, Dwayne said, "You know, I'm not an adventurous person, and my character should just leave." Wes asked him how he should leave, and Dwayne was like, "Cab." So Wes Craven took him up on it, which is just brilliant, and they got the cab. The car scene in the dummy script was that the cops were just taking Sydney to a safe house, and that Ghostface then caught up to them, pulled the cops out of the car. Sydney is, of course, by herself, so she ends up finding a pencil. She jams it into Ghostface's neck while he's driving, causing him to crash. Wes said that they actually updated that scene on the spot on set to follow along with what they already had, which was Hallie and Sydney going to the safe house. Elise Neal said that her and Neve Campbell kept getting in trouble during filming because they could not stop laughing. When it came time to film the ending, no one had the ending until they got on set the last day of principal photography. And of course, this film absolutely blew up and ended up making just about $1 million less than the original Scream for a sequel that's pretty damn incredible, and even more incredible when you realize we had just seen Scream less than a year beforehand. So I wanted to go over some of the cameos. We have Heather Graham, who plays Casey in Stab. Paulette Wilson is one of the theater employees passing out masks to Maureen and Phil. She won her cameo in a contest with MTV. Peter Deming is the cinematographer, who is the guy serving popcorn. Kevin Williamson is the man interviewing Cotton. Joshua Jackson plays a student in the film studies class. Julie Plec is an associate producer and assistant to Wes and Craven. She's a student in the film class. Selma Blair is actually the voice of the girl on the phone with Cece. If you go in the party scene when they're like at the sorority house, when it's on, I want to say Neve Campbell is who you see on screen. You'll see a blonde guy in the background. That is Matthew Lillard.
Is it true that you were in, you made an appearance in Scream 2?
Well, so I dated Neve Campbell for like a couple, for a while, and I walked through the back of one scene. I literally was hanging out with my friends in the back of one scene. Wes was like, "Walk through the back." That was the worst mistake I ever made.
Wes Craven plays a doctor in the scene where Derek gets stabbed. Tori Spelling plays Sydney in the Stab cameo. Nancy O'Dell is the Entertainment Tonight host who's interviewing her. And of course, Luke Wilson is Billy in Stab. Also want to go over the deaths and who did it. Pretty much the way I feel about this is that Mickey did most of the work. And we know for a fact that Mrs. Loomis kills Randy because she admits it. But I think most of her stuff, like her, she's more on the phone and she's talking to Sydney. Anybody with Woodsboro ties is going to be more on her side than Mickey. So you have Phil Stevens, Maureen Evans. They're obviously both killed by Mickey. Cece Cooper is Mickey who killed her, but she was on the phone with Mrs. Loomis. And then the attack on Sydney in the sorority house is Mickey with Mrs. Loomis on the phone. The attack on Sydney at the stage is Mickey. Randy is Mrs. Loomis. The library messages have to be from Mickey because it would make the most sense for him to be there versus Mrs. Loomis. And then you have Detective Andrews, Detective Richard, Hallie. That's all Mickey. I think the Gail and Dewey attacks from Mrs. Loomis because Gail's kind of hiding for a while. So that gives Debbie or Mrs. Loomis plenty of time to disrobe and be there waiting. Derek's attack is obviously Mickey because we see it. And then Mickey is killed by Sydney and Gail. And then Mrs. Loomis is caught and shoots her. But Sydney, you're assuming, does the final shot. So what do you think? Do you love Scream 2? Hate it? Let me know all of your thoughts. You can find me all over social media. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at TerrorTPod. We're also on Facebook in the Terror Tea group. You can catch horror news, among other things, over there, so come join us. If you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to the podcast, and if you really like it, leave me a 5-star review. Again, I'm your host, Tara, and this has been Terror Tea.